Life can be an extraordinary adventure. More than ordinary. In the gym. At home. At work. More than ordinary. Advice. Without the new agey bullshit. Our observant listeners may notice that the sound quality of More Than Ordinary is less than ordinary this week. We apologize for the technical difficulties and be assured we'll be back to our usual level of awesomeness next week. You're listening to More Than Ordinary. I'm Anne Maria DeMars.
And I'm Maria Burns Ortiz. Thanks for coming back for our second episode. I guess we were talking, we should pick up where we left off last time. You were talking a little bit about yourself, and basically we ended with you handcuffed spread eagle to the bed. And we knew that Daddy Warbucks didn't come and bail you out, but what did happen after that defining moment?
Well, after waiting for Daddy Warbucks to drop in a helicopter and rescue me, and that didn't happen. Yeah, the staff had said, we're not letting you up until you promise not to hit anybody again and say you're sorry. And I said, I'm never going to say I'm sorry, fuck you people. And that was how they left it. And you see these things on TV, and one of two things happens. Either you die, which obviously did not happen, or you magically wriggle out of the handcuffs and escape through the vents or something like that, and that didn't happen either. And in fact, like most such situations, it ended up a whole much more of a fizzle than a flame out. So
less dramatic but more realistic.
Yeah, there's kind of a standoff. I wasn't going to say I was sorry. I'm sure I did not spend 24 hours in handcuffs because I would have peed on myself. And they never show that. It's true, though. They never show that when they do those TV movie things. People are chained to the wall. If you were really chained to the wall for 2 or 3 days, you would pee on yourself. Unless maybe they didn't give you water. But anyway, that did not happen. And some ungodly hour in the morning, maybe 3, 4 in the morning, the woman who had the third shift at juvenile hall, usually I think her job was just to do the laundry, right? Because all the people are locked in their cells. And she comes in, and she's a little old African-American lady. And I say old, where probably she was 45 or 50, you know, younger than I am now. But it seemed old to me. And even as much of a jerk as I was not going to kick her in the face.
You had a standard.
Right, right. And my standards were above kicking the little ladies in the face. So she said to me, look, I cannot go along with this. You're being handcuffed here. So I'm a little lady. Just tell me you're not going to punch me or kick me, and I will unhandcuff you. And so I said, yeah, and she did. And so that was the end of that. So it was not very dramatic. And then I got out of juvenile hall and was back in again. And it all really sucked. And I mean, I talk about it now, like, and this, I'm in that. But I've never been a whiner and a crier. I mean, I realized very young, long before being handcuffed to a bed, that no one was going to come and rescue me. So I may as well pick it up. So anyway, going on from there, I ended up for a long time going to school. And this was the point I wanted to make in today's More Than Ordinary, is people want to be successful. They want to be more than ordinary, but they don't really want to put in the time and effort it takes. They think they do, but they don't realize how long it goes on. So I was 14 when that incident happened. 5 years later, when I was 19, I graduated from college. So it's like, oh, then it's great. But no, because I went to graduate school. And so it was another 2 years where I was taking the bus in the cold in Minnesota winters. And I know this sounds like I walked 9 miles to school barefoot in snow, uphill both ways.
But if you've been in Minnesota in the winter, you know that basically that's what it is.
Pretty much, yeah. And so from that point in juvenile hall until I got my MBA and actually started making a good living was 7 years. And it was 7 years. No, they didn't completely suck. I mean, during that time, I, you know, won the U.S. Open. I, you know, did graduate from college, and I wasn't as broke, but I was pretty broke for 7 years straight.
And even after that, it's not like you were living in a beach house, you know, with someone, with your butler bringing you pina coladas.
Right. It was a big improvement, though. I mean, I went, when I got my first real job, and I was working as an engineer, and, you know, making $35,000 a year or whatever, which 30 years ago was getting close to 40 years ago now, was decent money. But my point is that people think that they want to run a startup, or they want to win a world judo championships, or they want to, like you were talking last time, you know, be an award-winning journalist. And they think they're willing to put in the effort. But what they don't realize is whether you're talking about building a company or being an elite athlete or getting a PhD, that it's years of living on ramen and looking through your couch to find enough money to go to Dunkin' Donuts and,
and
buy a donut.
Well, they think they're willing to put the effort in, but they have absolutely no idea how much effort it takes. You're judging something you don't have any energy.
Where Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure is up against Forbidden Planet. And somebody just voted for Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Welcome to Game Fights, the Ponzi scheme of podcasting. I'm David Shaw. With me, as always, is Mr. Mike Ortiz.
So what are we fighting about this time, David?
Best sci-fi movie of all time. Best token minority. Best animated TV series.
Listen. GeekFights.net.
Hi, this is Chris Taylor from Glen Ellyn, Illinois, and you're listening to More Than Ordinary.
Hi, welcome back to More Than Ordinary. I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
And Maria DeMars, brought to you by 7 Generation Games. Do you want to make a difference in a person's life more than ordinary? You can donate a game to a child, to a classroom, to a school, www.7generationgames.com.
And that's 7 with a 7.
So, tips for being more than ordinary. So let's say you have been listening to this and you think, I do not want to be waiting in the snow for a bus. I don't want to spend 7 years going to school. Really, if you think about it that way, a lot of times it's really, really difficult to get motivated. So my best tip for people is to break it into small chunks. You don't have to run a marathon today. You don't have to learn an entire new programming language today. There are a couple of things that I've done that have made a noticeable difference. For example, I sit at my desk all the time. I write software. And I notice I'm starting to get those grandma arms, you know, the ones that look like kind of flabby wings. So a while back, I thought, you know what, I'm going to do push-ups every morning. So I started doing 10 push-ups every day for a week. And then the next week, I did 11. And I did that until I got up to 30 push-ups a day.
That's pretty good for an old lady.
It is, yeah. And I thought, well, I could keep doing it until I was 50 and 100. And then I thought, you know what, that's really stupid because I'm not, what is my goal?
An old lady.
Yeah. Well, my goal is not to be an old lady. I'm already an old lady, so that goal has been achieved. My goal was to not have flabby bat wing arms. And so, what?
That's a really good goal. I'm fully on board.
Well, you don't know anybody's goal who is to have flabby bat wing arms, right? She's mocking me, Dennis. So anyway, before I so rudely interrupt,
I got to edit that out.
Edit out all my rudeness. I got to doing 30 push-ups every morning. I thought, you know, that's good. That's enough. So you don't have to be, you know, setting the Guinness Book of World Records for most push-ups. Shout out to Bob Goldman, who has that world record. I know him. Founded International Sports Hall of Fame. No, I think it was, yeah, like 1,000 or more. But anyway, yeah, 30 push-ups every morning. That's it. I get out of the shower. I do 30 push-ups. If that... I see you envisioning. As a matter of fact, no. I am wearing nothing but a St. Jude medallion. This is the truth. And I do my 30 push-ups, and then I get dressed. Why are you so concerned about the order in which I do things?
It's like I jump out of the shower and I do naked push-ups.
I dry off first.
Great. All right, maybe we'll restart this.
I think it's an excellent segment. What do you think, Dennis?
Best one yet.
That's right. We're going to keep this. All right, my other guy, Alan, can edit as he sees fits. He will leave in the naked push-ups. So, anyway, my other tip related to that is when I decided I wanted to be a game programmer, write software, develop software for games. And I had done mostly statistical programming using things like SAS, and that's not really appropriate for games. done some Visual Basic macros. Again, not for games. Fortran. Nobody uses Fortran anymore. They're all dead except for me. So I decided to learn JavaScript, and I got the definitive guide for JavaScript, which is really a definitive guide. It's about, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of pages long, and Dennis thinks it's a good book. It is as boring as watching paint dry. But it really is the definitive guide. So every morning I would wake up and drink my coffee and for a half an hour or an hour read that book. And I've read the entire book now probably 1.5 times. So in other words, I read the whole book and then, you know, different chapters that I thought were pretty pertinent. And I really did, over the course of a year or so, learn a lot. So I would read that book every morning. And then when I got done with that book, I picked up another book, the jQuery Cookbook. Okay. I don't think we needed that sound effect, Dennis.
That was coffee pouring.
We needed that sound effect.
Just pick back up with, and then after that, I read the jQuery Cookbook.
And Eloquent JavaScript. So you get the point. Every morning, for a half an hour, I would read some technical book. And I did that for years. And I'm not as consistent about it as it was at the beginning. But if you look at what I can do now as opposed to a couple of years ago, it's really significant. So small chunks.
It's a lot easier to tackle a couple of pages as opposed to a 700-page book.
Right.
Right. Well, and you know, it's interesting. I wrote a little bit similar to this on my Parenting Like I Know What I'm Doing blog that we have on 7GenerationGames.com about how I was trying to get my house in order because I have three small children, so it's always chaotic. And how I had, you know, a couple of years ago, there was a story about Lindsay Lohan, who I have no idea what happened to her now, but the police went to her house because they thought she'd been robbed, but basically it turned out it was just trashed because it was a mess. And I kind of felt like I've been living in that a little bit. So I decided, well, I'm going to go in and start, instead of cleaning the entire house, or not even cleaning because I have a cleaning lady, but organizing it, just kind of doing one surface or one area at a time, and then going on that. And so it's been almost 2 weeks, and I wouldn't say my house is perfectly in order now, but I don't have to sit there and think, well, do I try and clean up, or should we just give up and wait until we move?
I've, on occasion, been tempted to just set the whole house on fire and claim it was arson.
Turns out there's laws against that, though. So our final parting tip on this, on today's episode, would be don't set your house on fire. Just take a little area at a time and go for it.
Anti-insurance fraud.
Right, exactly. Yes. Anti-law breaking.
Welcome back to More Than Ordinary,
podcast by 7Generation Games.
So our More Than Ordinary guest this week is a good friend of mine, Pete Antico. And what he has in common with our last More Than Ordinary guest, and really most of them, is I think he tends to underestimate his achievements in life. So Pete is a very successful professional in the movie industry. He does a lot of stunt work. You've probably seen him in a great many movies when you thought that was your favorite movie star, running across the train and jumping into the car that drives then in flames. It was actually Pete Antico. He also is an author. He has written a wonderful screenplay that I hope to see coming to the big screen soon called A Private War. That's a semi-autobiographical film talking about being a person with Tourette's disorder, growing up with parents who were very loving but not aware what the heck a neurological disorder was, and then going on to be a successful athlete, stunt person, author, and also director. So, Maria, did you have the first question for Pete?
One of the things that I think people will be really interested in just off the bat is how does somebody realize that they, one, want to be a stuntman, and then, two, get into it?
Well, I have an individual story. When I was in college, my professor wanted me to go to law school. I was in English and political science and economics. And I had, you know, Tourette syndrome. I got diagnosed when I was 14. So I was sitting in a chair, you know, ever since, you know, kindergarten. I was so fed up with sitting in a chair. It was so hard to sit still that I said, I really just can't do this anymore. I want to do something that frees me up a little bit. And I met a guy in Ventura named Monty Cox, whose wife got eaten by the shark in Jaws #1. And, you know, I heard he was a stuntman, and I said, wow, that's awesome. And I was a pole vaulter at California Lutheran University.
Shout out to pole vaulters. I was one, too.
Awesome. I was a pole vaulter at Moorpark College and at California Lutheran University. And I was a baseball player at Moorpark College as well. And I ran track and played football and wrestled. And I was just a jock all the way around. And I said, wow, what an awesome way maybe to make a living. I can just do a bunch of athletics and get paid for it. And I could kind of mask the Tourette syndrome, because if you crash through things, then no one cares if you're, you know, moving around. So I ended up going.
You could say, I meant to do that. I meant to crash through that thing.
So, I mean, I went to this stunt school, a very famous stuntman named Paul Stater, you know, who did things like the Poseidon Adventure, old movies, and The Great Race with Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon. Old, phenomenal, phenomenal movies. He lived in Malibu, and I ended up, you know, studying there and getting the bug. It was so awesome at that particular time. It was about 1979 and 1980. And there were some really good people, and I ended up breaking into the you know, film business that way by meeting other people that coordinated stunts.
So one of the other things that we look at in this podcast is people that are more than ordinary and people that overcome challenges. And you talked a little bit about being diagnosed with Tourette's when you were 14. One, what was that like? But two, what was it also like growing up not knowing what you had?
Well, God, when I was, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, no one knew what I had. I was making these crazy noises, moving around uncontrollably. I mean, I remember waking up when I was young. I started moving and, you know, jerking around and saying, like, all kinds of profanity. And only 5% of the people with Tourette's have, that's called coprolalia. I was exhausted by the time I went to sleep, and the only time I got any relief is when I slept. Nobody knew what it was. I went to doctors. They thought I was hyperactive. They gave me Ritalin one time, and my mother threw that down the toilet. And then they gave me something called Haloperidol, which is a series of drug, but it made me, you know, like catatonic, sitting on the couch drooling. And after 3 weeks, I refused to take that anymore. I told my mother and father I'd rather tick, I'd rather move and continue being athletic than to feel like that I can't go on living. So I made that conscious choice. And then when I was 14, I went to the City of Hope Medical Center, and I got diagnosed with something that I never heard of called Tourette syndrome. And I was so happy. And my father always thought I could control it with, you know, my mind. And I said, well, you know, I was just like I was yelling and screaming. And then the doctor gave me the bad news that there was no cure. And so I felt, you know, so depressed at that particular moment. And I said, well, wow, I have to live my entire life like this? Fuck that. I said, what a depressing moment.
I guess listening, people will learn a lot about Tourette's like me. Now, are there things that are sort of like triggers? Like, I know sometimes people have epilepsy. There are certain triggers that might set off seizures. Are there certain circumstances that might set off, like if people get more nervous, or is it completely unrelated to any of that?
No, they've noted that people that when they're under a lot of stress, they can have more symptoms, or they're eating a lot of drinking a lot of caffeine or eating a lot of sugar. They can have, or they're on less sleep. That has been noted for the symptomology, to increase.
I want to talk about what you've done in your life and how you got there. Like, what's the most difficult movie you ever worked on? Most difficult stunt you ever did?
Well, you know, I think the most difficult bits of action are not so much when you're in a car with a roll cage and you might have explosives and you're either hitting a ramp or you're sliding into things.
I would just like to point out, he just said it's not that difficult. It's not too difficult when you're in a car filled with explosives. So you really are going to want to hear what comes next.
Well, you know, the situation is when you're protected. For me, the most difficult things is when you're doing something precision, you know, or high speed, you know, driving sequence when you're around a whole crew of people. Because, you know, if you have a lot of cars and explosions and pyrotechnics all working in the same shot, and people are responsible for hitting their marks, even the people that are just pulling out in traffic that cars have to slide around, everyone has to do their job at the right timing. If they don't, you know, crews could get really injured. You know, people could get, you know, hurt or killed. That has happened before. And we rely on the collective group of people that can think really well under pressure. And if a curveball is thrown, if a car moves too far to the left, that everybody adjusts because they're professionals and they understand how to give and take, not someone that's myopic, myopically focuses and just points himself in one direction and goes forward and is oblivious to everything that goes on around him. That's what we try to avoid. Because when you're doing stunts at a high level, you want the people around you to be really proficient. So I learned that at a young age. I had some of the best teachers and, you know, the people, the original Stunts Unlimited members, you know, spearheaded by the world famous Hal Needham, the only stuntman to win an Academy Award they gave him, which is awesome. You know, and people like Tommy Huff was a brilliant mentor. He was the one that doubled Dan Aykroyd in the Blues Brothers and did all the driving, no CGI, the early boys, no CGI. Gary the Wiz McClarty did, you know, all the Blues Brothers, the Days of Thunder. Beverly Hills Cop did the big famous tractor trailer. Truck Tracy was doing all the driving. These people were phenomenally gifted innovators that would keep the entire cast and crew safe. And they taught me from the ground level up in the old school way how to be safe and take as much risk out of the equation, because some people are supposed to make it look like we're, you know, blowing up and doing the most voracious kinds of action, and yet, you know, come out of it, you know, safely. So that's something that I'm you know, proud to do. I've been fortunate enough to double Sylvester Stallone and Don Johnson, Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, and some high level, you know, film actors. And those are great relationships, because we make them look good. We don't challenge them. That, you know, it's not like there's any ego involved, because I'm not acting with them. I'm just doing the best I can to make them look like the heroes they're playing in, you know, in the films.
You know, and so breaking into Hollywood, no matter what you're doing, whether you're a stunt person or an actor or in costuming or whatever, is very competitive. And you know, you talked about you had Tourette's. Did you think that would be an obstacle? Were there concerns? Did you run up against issues going out for those jobs?
Good question. I always hid, you know, up till I was like 26 years old, I used to tell everybody I was hyperactive. Well, I'm just hyperactive. And they would look at me funny. Then I got an opportunity. I studied acting a long time. I loved to do that. And the reason why I did stunts, because I was able to hide the fact that I was moving around as a way to me to function in the world and be accepted. Because the main thing that got me accepted when I was a kid was being athletic. And when kids used to make fun of me, which was horrible when I was a kid, because kids don't know any better, the only way that I could fight back is I would get so much better than they were at an athletic event. And then I would just tell them to piss off. You're not as good as me at this. It was my way of fighting back. And that was the only defense mechanism, you know, I had. So when I was doing stunt work, I hid that fact. And then I got a couple of breaks acting, and I did a supporting role in a movie called 29th Street with Danny Aiello, and I did Lethal Weapon 3 with Mel Gibson, played one of the main bad guys. And Entertainment Tonight wanted to do an interview with me, so I did it, and I said, I'll only do it under one condition. If I can do, I want to spin it and come out and say that I have a neurological disorder called Tourette syndrome, because I wanted to help children to understand that no matter what they have, if they put their mind to it, that they can be successful. And it doesn't, it's not a handicap. It's whatever you say in your mind. It's like the same thing that, you know, the conversation on the planet is no one can be the heavyweight champion out of the world at age 20, but someone forgot to tell Mike Tyson that. Because if you don't live in someone else's universe and you live in your own, you can create anything and you can do anything that you want to do. There's no one that has the right to tell you what you can do and how successful you can be, but you, because you're the governor and the master of your own universe. So I came out and did this Entertainment Tonight interview, and everybody called me from all over the United States saying, what chapter are you with? Who got you to do that interview? And why would you do that interview in regards to Tourette's? Because I wanted to let children know. And at that point, the Tourette Syndrome Association called me and asked me if I would speak with Dr. Oliver Sacks in New York City at their symposium, who's a very famous. He wrote great books like The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat.
Yeah, that's a great book.
Yeah. So I got fascinatingly, you know, interested in how this works, because I used to see parents tell their kids and be very fearful, you know, my kid won't grow up to do anything. I mean, my mother and father didn't know how I would function in society. I remember when I was a kid, they were awesome people, but they were worried.
I want to point out a couple of things here. First of all, I've known you for years. You were in Lethal Weapon. So you were in a couple of these movies that everybody's seen, and I've known you for years. You just never quite mentioned it. Oh yeah, that was that thing I did back then. Like a billion people saw it. Oh yeah, it was that thing. So that's pretty funny. I think that again is a characteristic of people who are more than ordinary. I always say, I don't think if you met Wayne Gretzky, he would find it necessary to tell you he was good at hockey. And I'm always very underwhelmed by people when I first meet them. They have to tell me everything they did and give me their resume.
As if you know what you did and you actually know who you are, you don't need credit for anything because it's superfluous.
Well, with that, we're going to have to end for today. This has been More Than Ordinary from Seven Generation Games. We're going to have you back, Pete, because that was just fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the More Than Ordinary podcast.
For more information, please go to our website, 7generationgames.com. And that's 7 as in the number 7, generationgames.com.
If you'd like to learn more about math and history, or increase your vocabulary while at the same time having fun, you can purchase our games at 7generationgames.com/buy.
You can also donate and help a much-deserving student.
And as always, please tell a friend and don't forget to rate us on iTunes.
It's never too late to be more than ordinary.